Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome, everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I'm Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and William, AC2ZV, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder, and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of the website in orange colored type, but if you would like to have a simple URL to directly get to it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All of this information can also be found on our club's website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and William AC2ZV will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, William AC2ZV. Good evening, William.
AC2ZV out here. The TechNet tonight, Roy.
Okay, very good, William. I'm glad to have you here. Bob is off celebrating Thanksgiving with his family outside of New York, so he's not available tonight. I appreciate William pitch hitting for him tonight. So once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If there's anyone out there who has any questions or comments, questions about technology, science, amateur radio would be great, but we'll try anything. So if anyone is out there and would like to throw us either a question or start a topic going, please hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your call sign. Well, what do you know? A somewhat quiet beginning. Pretty much as per usual. Let me just throw an anecdote at you. Every so often, at least on the 10-meter net, when there are people who are participating, I ask them if they bought any new toys. It's usually a good conversation starter. I just received a great toy that I gave myself, either late birthday, early Hanukkah, who knows. A Prusa XL, that's the large size multi-tool 3D printmaker. I bought it pre-assembled because I didn't want to spend a week assembling it for a number of reasons. So it came pre-assembled, sort of. That means that it took me the better part of about 3 hours finishing the assembly. You had to put the heads in and align it and do a couple other little bits and pieces. One fascinating thing is when I ran the calibration program, smack dab in the middle of it, it blew a fuse and died. So, of course, I called Prague, which is where it's manufactured, and asked what's up. And he didn't quite know. I didn't quite know. I was able to pull the blown fuse, replace it, because we all have mini auto 5-amp fuses in a file cabinet someplace, and started up and updated the firmware and the crossed fingers and tried it a few times and got it to actually go through all the calibrations, and now it's working. And now I have to figure out exactly the weirdnesses that this particular 3D printer possess. I already had a little problem with the filaments breaking, but, you know, filaments will do that, unfortunately. But it's a fun time, and it's a nice toy, so I just thought I'd share. And also, it meant filling some the vacuum of silence. So if anyone is curious and or interested about my new little toy, or they have another topic for discussion, please feel free. Hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
Wondering what actually you'll be able to print, like what kind of plastic or whatever it is you have in the filament. Are you able to use different kinds in that machine, or what's the story with that?
Well, yeah, generally 3D printers kind of have a relative wide range of plastics and nylon to choose from. It probably, there's a range of temperatures that these filaments work best at. So at lower temperatures, I'm talking something like 210 degrees centigrade, PLA, ABS work fine. You need to go up a little bit higher for something called PETG, and ultimately at somewhat higher temperatures, you can even use carbon fibers. They tend to be a little abrasive, and they wear down nozzles after a while. But there's a large slew of plastics that can be used in as filaments to make any kind of three-dimensional shape that you can create on a CAD/CAM program. You just, you know, and a lot of them are pre-written by other guys who are much more artistic than I am. And mine is capable of five different filaments in the tool at once. So it can shift either to five different types of material, which is a little dicey to do because some things don't stick well to other things. But more important, you can put five spools of five different colors of the same PLA or ABS, and you can have a five-color plastic model generated without the need to paint anything.
Awesome. So what's your first project going to be? Have you got that figured out yet?
I'm trying to figure out exactly the idiosyncrasies. I'm printing little figures and seeing what works and what doesn't work. You know, I don't want to scale it up and go too fast before I figure out how the little things work. So it'll be a learning experience. It's very weird. Also, unfortunately, I like to play at the bleeding edge. So a lot of the software that runs this thing is alpha. It's not even beta. Some of them are reverse candidates, thankfully, but a lot of them are alphas. So things that should work don't quite work. Things that you would think wouldn't work do work. I can't control, it works by a sneaker net. At this point, which is I go to my computer, I dump things onto a USB stick, I walk over to the 3D printer and stick the USB stick in and run the print jobs. Theoretically, I should be able to do it remotely from the computer. And I've discovered a way of doing it remotely the long way around, through the internet. And yet, I haven't quite figured out how to just directly connect from my LAN to the Wi-Fi. It's obviously working because the printer's Wi-Fi is going into the internet, allowing me to control it via the internet, just not via my local network. So it's probably some firmware problem that they haven't addressed yet. So I'll be looking for future firmware updates.
What do you mean about that? I saw a lot of interesting things on YouTube from these guys that print this stuff up, and then they make these stupid experiments, and they blow it up or whatever they do. One of them I saw was pretty interesting was the guy, he developed a different kind of propeller. And so he was printing those up in different ways to make, like, lower noise and better airflow kind of propellers. And the interesting was that the kind of tips actually touched each other, so it was a circle around the outside. It was more mass than a regular propeller, but maybe it's good for a drone. I don't know.
Yeah, I've seen that with fan designs. There's a guy who's trying to get people to volunteer designs that either he prints out or they send him, and he tests to see the amount of power required, the volume of air that's pushed through it, and you know, that sort of, and the noise that's produced by the fan. So he's not quite looking at propellers, but it's the same aerodynamics for a different purpose. He's looking for the ultimate quiet, efficient, powerful computer fan.
Like those people end up needing water-cooled computers.
Well, I don't know. It sort of depends. Water cooling is nice, but it's not certainly perfect. And, you know, if your fan dies and malfunctions, the worst that happens is you have a noisy fan. Your water-cooled system gets a leak, and you got a lot of problems. So I looked into the possibility of getting a water cooling system, and although for the most part, I haven't read or heard of too many horror stories. I don't know if I like the idea of a bunch of water sloshing around an expensive motherboard and chips and such that would probably have to be replaced if water fell on them. I don't know if you've ever seen it. There are liquids that are not water, that are not conductive, that you can immerse a computer into. And because of the heat losses in liquids is much more efficient than solids, it's kind of like one big water cooler, except that it's not water. It's a very esoteric fluoridated compound that I think 3M makes.
Probably just the oil that they have in the transformers might even work too, because that's all they really do inside the transformers that are on poles with Con Ed. They're just full of oil, the special oil, but it was a kind of oil.
Same principle, but I don't think I'd want to try it on computer components because, you know, you have to kind of go back in eventually. And with this 3M liquid, you can pour it all out and it's out. Whereas if you try and pour oil out, there's always going to be a layer of it covering everything. So I don't know. Yeah, I've heard people, they use it for dummy loads, which is fine because if you have a greasy 50-ohm non-inductive resistor, you know, no one really cares much. But again, if you have thousands of dollars of graphic boards and all kinds of fun stuff, and it's got a thick layer of oil all over it, you know, unless you can convince someone to fry it up and eat it, you know, it's going to be problematic.
Usually the systems I've seen just are basically piping in and out of chip headers that have, you know, high-powered chips radiate a lot of heat, and they have like an antifreeze thing with LEDs and stuff like that in the front, you know, to make it look really cool.
Yeah, the usual way of doing it is just using water with some kind of, you have to, I don't think it's antifreeze, because most people are not going to be worried about their computer freezing off. If anything, probably boiling it off is more of a problem. They'll do a color it just to make it fancy, in the same way that flashing LEDs don't do anything really useful. And some people love them. I was never a big fan. I like lighting, but I like it to be a little on the subtle side. And I've seen some expensive rigs where it's nothing close to being subtle. But what's very important is that people put an additive into the liquid so that it doesn't build up bacteria or mold or other such things, which if you just ran kind of distilled water and nothing else, you probably would get something nasty growing there in a couple of years. So I think that's the additive that really counts for fluid-cooled computers.
The heat transfer fluid, like like antifreeze, they have different colors of antifreeze, so that's all tinted and that doesn't let bacteria grow. It takes a lot of high temperature, so it's probably something similar to that, but probably more geared towards the computer enthusiast, so it's more expensive.
Well, again, I'm not quite sure. The additives probably are different for everyone, but I don't think they used ethylene glycol. The reason really why they put the ethylene glycol in there is because it has a lower freezing point. And again, you'd have to have a very weird environment if you're concerned that the fluid in your cooling system is going to be so great that all of a sudden everything freezes over. So what's more important to guys running computer cooling systems is to use some kind of antibacterial, antifungal agent. The colorant is just for to make it pretty.
Or actually physical chemicals, which were actually better for heat transfer than water, and so the volume you needed for a certain amount of heat transfer was less with proper heat transfer chemicals. So I'm not exactly sure what those are, but that's what I thought it was, and then that stuff was colored, but who knows? I have to look it up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are guys out there who have tried interesting other things. Usually keeping it simple is the best approach. So if they start off with just something like water instead of some esoteric expensive liquid that has a slightly better thermal dissipation rate, every so often there are guys who are a little bit too clever for the room or themselves, and they'll come up with some heat dissipation a technique that uses toxic materials. As long as they're sealed perfectly, there's no problem, but nothing stays sealed forever. And so when those things go bad, they can go very, very bad. Usually those are ventures where the business kind of collapses in on itself within months, because everyone figures out that they don't want a time bomb sitting next to them in a computer.
Very good point. You don't want to have to dispose of it and have a disposal problem.
Yeah, I mean, most consumers want to keep it simple. As it is, it's become a big pain in the backside. I don't know if it is for you as much as it is for me. I don't usually hold on to old broken stuff. In the old days, I would fix it for many reasons. I don't have the time or the interest, and newer stuff is more interesting to me than the old stuff. So I'm looking to throw stuff out, and in the old days, you just put it in the garbage can and it was gone. Nowadays, there's a special day for this and a special day for that, and we're not even going to pick these things up. You have to, carry it on the bus and bring it to some place once every, three times a year. So it's getting more and more difficult to throw away stuff these days.
Fluorescent tubes, those are very difficult to get rid of those.
Fortunately, there's a laundry list of things. You can't get rid of any electrical equipment. You have to take it down on a special day, supposedly for recycling. But I tend to think that the sanitation department is fooling us about recycling any of this stuff. You know, we put it in different containers. They grab it in different days. And I think they put it in the same pile. I saw a funny as hell video, YouTube, in China, where they have containers that have three or four different openings. It's like wedges of a pizza, if you will. And you're supposed to put the paper stuff in one quarter of it, and metals in another quarter of it, and something else in another quarter of it. So it's a kind of a four or five-in-one recycling container. And they took the top of it off to show that no matter where you threw the thing, it went to the same big bag underneath. So their recycling nonsense is even more nonsensical than ours.
Virginia, where I have a cabin, you just go there. It seems like it's easier in rural areas than it is in the city, because if you're just in a rural area, you just drive out to recycling center. They got bins for everything. It's all lined up. There's a swap shop. All the stuff is sitting around. You just drive over with a whole car load. They weigh you in. They weigh you out. You're done. And if you want something from the swap shop, you get it. You know, it's much more of pleasant than going to the sanitation department.
By the way, I think the problem is, as nice as that is, it doesn't scale up well. And so you have to kind of multiply it by the population of Brooklyn and Queens. When you start doing that, everything breaks.
So much. But you know, it's amazing the transition that the city has made, telling people to start using garbage cans rather than put their trash out in the street. All the businesses around here have switched over. It's very interesting to see. I think it's an improvement.
Certainly is a cleaner way of dealing with it. It might cut down the rat population by about 3-4%. Any decrease is a good thing. There was some kind of rumor that the sanitation department was only going to allow one type of garbage can or something weirdly like that. They, they recently changed the rules about putting garbage out on the curb. In the old days, you could do it, I think, in the afternoon. Now, I think the edict is that you can't put your garbage out until something like 6 o'clock at night before the next day's garbage pickup. So I don't know. I don't think that kind of makes any difference about anything. I mean, even if you look at the small print of sanitation and such, you're not supposed to throw away your alkaline batteries. I'm not quite sure where you're supposed to put them. But, you know, every so often when I pick up a new package of alkaline batteries, it says, caution, do not dispose of in general garbage. So, I'm still not quite sure exactly where you're supposed to go with your alkalines. They keep saying that you got to do something special. They don't really go into detail. And my guess is 99.9% of people just throw them in the garbage.
I can tell you that 311 used to tell me to throw them in the garbage. I don't know if that's their current advice. It seems like these things change. You know, it used to be you take your fluorescent tubes, you smash them, you put them in a trash can, and they took it. But it's not like that anymore. So all these rules change, and you don't necessarily know about it. If you know the old rules, it's, oh, just do it like I used to, and then, bam, you're in trouble or something like that. But it seems like there should be a better way.
I'm sure there should be, and there probably is, and no one's going to try that one. I think one of the reasons why the fluorescent light bulbs are as big a problem, realistically, that they are a big problem. I don't know if it's as much of a problem these days, but early on, they're basically mercury vapor UV lights that are coated with a visible fluorescent material on their surface. So mercury can be very poisoning. There's theories that Isaac Newton kind of went a little weird at one point. He was also into alchemy, and the thought was that he was working way too much with mercury and got a bit of mercury poisoning. Mercury poisoning is the reason why the Mad Hatter exists in literature, because hatters suffered mercury poisoning a lot. They worked the felts with mercury compounds. And there was a large percentage of people in the hat-making industry who suffered mercury poisoning and became neurologically really weird.
I think that's really interesting. I got that connection. So what happens to you if you're a Mad Hatter? Do you just act crazy all the time? How is it displayed in terms of personality change or something like that?
It's very varied in its presentation. It can lead to just psychosis or almost senile-like absences of mind, forgetfulness, confusion, erratic muscle movements. It's not a standard type of madness, which is probably one of the ways in the old days. Well, they probably didn't know anything, but I think they were able to correlate it with mercury use enough to know that when you went batty, it was because of mercury. So that was kind of the very beginnings of people understanding that materials that we tend to take for granted are hazard to us. You know, I mean, there's so many other things. Lead, a heavy metal, also produces neurological deficits. Every so often people will suggest that because children suffered from pica, they ate lead paint in their childhood, that's possibly a reason why a lot of them did not develop neurologically, and they ain't too clever. This is not an excuse in the last 40, 50 years because they've taken the lead out of paint. They've taken a lot of the lead out of gasoline, except that they've kept it in plain, non-jet fuel. Gasoline is still leaded. So private planes and smaller things that aren't quite jets still pollute the sky with lead.
Heard that there was a lot of issues with pewter in the old days. They had pewter tableware and stuff like that, and people got lead poisoning from their pewter cups and stuff. I think Beethoven was supposed to have had lead poisoning from his cup.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of historical stories of possibly what caused people to have problems. There's a fable that I don't think is correct, that they used mercury as a coloring agent in wallpaper, and the last place that Napoleon lived, before he just died, after attempting to reconquer France repeatedly. So there was a lot of talk about him ultimately dying of mercury poisoning just from the wallpaper materials and such. I don't think that's true. But yeah, I mean, just recently in Flint, the water problem was due to the fact that some of their water intake pipes were lead, and they shifted from the river to from one place to another place where the pH was a little different, and the lead kind of flaked off, and you couldn't drink the water in Flint, Michigan for years.
What about that story?
This is probably going to be increasing a problem because people are not really dealing still with the infrastructure. There's trillions of dollars of infrastructure throughout this country. The stuff works when it's new, but eventually has to be replaced. And the last thing that government likes to do is replace things they already have. because it ain't sexy and it's expensive. So there's probably going to be more of problems with tainted water supplies as the decades go on, and politicians figure out that they don't want to spend their tax resources on things that will save people's lives.
We have lead pipes here in Brooklyn, too, still. I mean, these buildings are very old.
Yeah, it's not at all uncommon. Usually, these days, if they're going to use lead, they'll use it for the waste pipes, because we don't really care if we're poisoning the rats in the sewer system and such. So, you know, you try and stay away from that as intakes of our water supply. New York, you know, I mean, people kind of piss on New York regularly, but New York has a history of having excellent water. They have very good treatment facilities. And I think it usually, whenever they rate municipal water supplies, New York City comes up on top of the lists.
Down in Mississippi, they basically have people don't even want to pay to have these people have proper water in their neighborhood. So that's really a problem.
Well, that's the short-sightedness of humanity in general. You know, what's in it for me? What do I benefit from it? If I have to pay my taxes and the other guy gets a benefit, it's not fair. So, you know, there's a lot of very, very poorly thought out. I tend to blame the education system. Our country is not deep into critical thought. At best, rote. But not too much about critical thought. So there's a lot of silly people out there who are very short-sighted and very selfish. And that usually doesn't work well with a massive population of people. You know, if you live in a little island someplace off with 50 people, maybe you can get away with being like that. You know, that's what these libertarians are kind of dreaming of, that they can find some island where they won't be subject to any kind of enforcement of any laws, that they'll be able to do whatever they feel like doing. And then they realize that such a place is not going to be fun for most of the people in there. So not too many people ultimately want to go there, and usually all the good real estate is already filled with people who aren't crazy like themselves. So these crypto bros and such who drank deeply of libertarian nonsense and want an you can do anything you feel like. That doesn't go well with a civilization. It usually degenerates into something, you know, seen once upon a time after the French Revolution. That was a demonstration of what happens when there are no regulations on hand.
Roy, maybe we ought to talk about the puzzle.
Out, who knows, maybe someone who isn't preparing, I guess, for Thanksgiving or something finally is listening to us. Maybe we could get a third member of the little club here. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. And we're open for business. If there's anyone out there who has any questions or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk and ID yourself. Anyway, I guess we'll go to the puzzle, William. How's that? So are you on the page? Because it is a schematic. It's a UK schematic, because I got it from the UK, that uses little rectangles instead of zigzags for resistors. So are you on the page, William?
Something didn't work. I'm going to have to try typing it out. Something is wrong.
Okay, I'll give you a moment.
There with the arrow.
detector. It's basically described as an envelope detector of a receiver. That's what's used for detecting AM signals and turning them into audio signals so that you can listen. Most people in our hobby tend to be very familiar with that idea because that's basically what the crystal does in a crystal radio set. So it's a diagram of an AM demodulator or a diode envelope detector of a receiver. And the question is, this is the circuit of a diode envelope detector of a receiver. What is connected to Y? So Y is the input of the AM detector. So that's the question. What would be connected to an AM detector that would make sense? And you got four choices. Choice A is an IF shift control. B is a volume control. C is a squelch control. And D is the final IF transformer. So since it's just you and me, William, it's up to you. What do you think is the correct answer for this?
It's possibly that the volume control is on the resistor on the right.
Yes, you are absolutely positively right. Both the volume control and the squelch controls are to the other side, where it's dealing with an audio signal. The IF shift control is further in the middle of the IF stages. So it would be the final IF stages transformer that would go into the detector. It would short out basically the carrier. It would summon difference the sidebands and generate a low frequency audio signal that would then probably be fed into a adjustable gain amplifier circuit for your volume, and then out to a transducer, better known as a speaker. So you are absolutely positively correct. So we're almost done for tonight. I will, the endless optimist me, give people the opportunity to still ask a question if there's someone out there listening to us. So once again, I am still AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. We try and get together and talk about radios and technology, what have you. So if there's anyone out there with any technical questions or topics that they would like to discuss, please, this is probably your last moment to do this. Hit the push to talk. Okay, very good. Glad to see you, Max. What can I do you for?
Thing to listen to the transit authority, like kind of a communications, like on the trains, because it's not, it's publicly public airways, not encrypted or anything. But that was like, oh, that's interesting. You could listen to that. And I'm like, wait, is that legal to listen? And my answer is probably like, well, it's unencrypted. It's as long as you have a radio that can hear it and you're not transmitting on those frequencies, you probably can. So that's kind of part one, is like, what are the rules around listening? And part two, like, if it is okay to listen, what would you use? Because I was looking, for example, at the Baofeng, and it's not, it can't even hit those frequencies. So I can, I can't key them up. So I can't even listen even if I don't intend to transmit. So how does this whole thing work on those more commercial frequencies, I guess?
Okay, that's a good question. You can theoretically, well, there's two kinds of transmissions that public agencies use. In the old days, they were just FM. And so if you had a broad frequency range receiver handy talkie and you knew the frequencies, you could listen to their transmissions. Usually it's intent is more important than action. So as long as you're not doing it for something questionable, they're usually good with it. That had a very weird kind of implementation as far as the police frequencies were concerned. if you weren't something like a reporter or your job was to listen to chit-chat on the police radio, you could listen stationary, you know, a base station. But if they found a police scanner in your car, they just assumed that you were doing it for some nefarious reason, and they would give you a ticket for something like that. Now, the problem is that over the years, they've shifted from simple FM selected frequencies to more esoteric stuff called trunking. Trunking is a curious and interesting technology in which there is a frequency that you check into at the beginning of any kind of a transmission. It selects an open channel available to the service and then tells you to go to that channel. So if you were listening on a trunking radio service without another trunking radio in your hand, you would maybe hear little bits and pieces of a conversation, but you wouldn't be able to kind of piece it together well. You know, but there are trunking scanners out there. But there are also the new technology encrypts it. So now you're stuck. So once they encrypt it, the cost of breaking the encryption is probably not in the realm of most of us. So I think that answers the question. If not, feel free to expand on the question. You need a broad range, broad coverage radio to pick up the FM signals, or a trunking capable scanner. And there's nothing you could do about encrypted channels, though.
Require radio rather than the regular standard handheld fare for the 2 meter and 70 centimeter. That's really interesting, because I was kind of thinking you could like listen to it. Because it's also the same thing with the ATS bands, right? Because I can listen to those bands more or less with I guess that is technically a broadband radio. It just doesn't have any transmit functionality, which is good because I don't feel like transmitting on those transmissions anyways. But so I guess that's kind of like you can do an SDR solution to do that. Exactly, mobile then. Interesting. Have you done anything like that?
Amateur radio operators kind of came from three branches. Some of them were guys who got drafted and ended up in the Signal Corps, and when they came out, they had a taste for radios. I came up from the shortwave listener. I conned my parents into buying a AM/FM radio that included shortwave, and gamed it so that I could listen to single sideband and listen to a bunch of hams at night. The other branch is the CBers. So I was kind of doing that back in the 60s and the early 70s. I discovered that my cheap, really cheap AM radio could receive outside the band. And if I twisted the dial all the way up, I hit the marine telecommunications frequencies, and I would listen into phone chats that, you know, when people were doing ship to shore on radio telephones. You could listen in on them. They were standard AM signals. But I kind of ran, you know, through that in my childhood. So, you know, I mean, there are guys actually to this day, I hope that it's not happening now anymore, who used to listen into the McDonald's squawk boxes, because those squawk boxes are not wired together. They're wireless. So if you're near a McDonald's, at least in the past, and you tuned into the frequency, you could hear people ordering fries, which didn't really strike me as a good way of spending time personally, but, you know, each to their own.
For esoteric fries orders, I want my fries with cheese, hold the gravy. Interesting. All right, so I got to do a little bit of reading about a type of equipment. I was just curious because I get a lot of air traffic and actually a lot of marine traffic right outside of my window, so it was kind of interesting to see like what I can pick up, how the communications work. But something interesting because I played around for a hot second there, research. But thank you, that does help understand. Cool. Thank you.
I knew the guy who designed the previous, the present generation of subway communications. He was very proud of his work.
I'm sure you did a good job. I'm just curious how it works. It is a big system and obviously a lot of obstructions. Interesting. Well, nonetheless, have you done anything interesting in the radio land or technology land lately?
Well, you know, of course, there's the good old 10-meter net. That's always there. I mentioned earlier on the TechNet that I just got my Prusa XL. And I bought it pre-assembled, which is an interesting way of describing it, because it took me about 4 hours to assemble the pre-assembled thing. And I ran a calibration program, and right in the middle of the calibration program, it blew a fuse.
Yeah, I think I was telling you that I got the Prusa Mini, and it was a pre-assembled version as well, and it's like halfway assembled. The arms are assembled. We still got to put it together, and I did that with, at the time, my daughter was 4, so that was fun. It was, I guess, 4. But that sucks. The fuse blows right away, yeah. The good thing about Prusa is that they have usually very good customer support, so hopefully they'll be pretty responsive.
Well, you know, I contacted them. It happened last night. Yeah, last night. Actually, he was almost as confused as I was. He had me kind of pulling fuses because, you know, I kind of told him I think the fuse blew because everything but the power indicator on the light switch went out. So, you know, he didn't quite believe me. I said, turn it off. Let it wait, turn it back on. I don't think there's any thermal reset fuses in this thing. And so finally he said, okay, open up the back and take a picture and send it to me. And he said, okay, pull that fuse. So I pulled that fuse and it was fine. He said, geez, I don't know. What the hell? Pull the fuse in behind it. So I pulled the fuse behind it and sure enough, it had blown. It was it's a mini automotive fuse. 5 amps. So I guess he's used to maker types, thankfully, because he asked, do you happen to have any fuses? So I said, of course I do. So I put the fuse, I swapped the fuse, and I turned it back on, and came back to life. So, I kind of said, geez, should I go for broke and try the calibration again? And he said, well, it depends. How many fuses do you have? So I told him, well, now I have 9 fuses left. So he said, yeah, what the hell, go for it. It blinked a little bit, it coughed a little bit, but I got it through the calibration routines, and it's been behaving. But there's other strange things that I haven't quite figured out with it. It's supposed to be a Wi-Fi connected, which after a while it was, but you should be able to control it locally. I can't control it locally, but somehow I can control it through the entire internet. So in other words, the way it's configured or the firmware problem is that the direct local control isn't quite working, but it goes out to the internet, into their web servers, over to my web browser, where I can control it through the web browser. So it's a learning experience, to say the least.
If things are continuing to work, maybe it was just a bad fuse rather than something that was actually overloading the fuse. And that would be worried about, right? Like blowing a fuse, like they say, oh, just replace the fuse. Like the fuse isn't the problem. The problem is that the fuse blew because you've probably used more than 5 amps. So it sounds like here might actually just be a faulty fuse rather than kind of a system issue.
Yeah, that's my guess. I was concerned it was heating up the base. You know, the base has those addressable heating elements that go like a matrix on the base. So my worry was that one of the elements was shorted. Because I've read in the past that people got these things, and usually the problem was the opposite. that when it checks to see if they're all wired up correctly, it shows one that's open, that the connector didn't quite work. So I was concerned that one of those elements might be shorted, and because obviously that would blow the fuse. But apparently not. It might have been a kind of built-in glitch to the firmware, and it could have been a weakness in that particular 5-amp fuse. It's just a good thing that I carry a whole range of fuses in my little collection.
Are you planning to print on the ginormous printer that you have now?
I don't know. Like I mentioned earlier to William, what I'm going to probably, I never particularly had an idea that I'm going to do this or that, because that's kind of self-limited. You know, it's kind of like buying a hammer and saying, well, what are you going to do with it other than just bang nails? What are you going to do with the nails? You know, what are they going to make? So to me, it's a nice toy. It's a nice thing. It kind of opens all the kinds of options. I have a lot of rolls of filament from my previous 3D printer that I just got tired of wasting a lot of plastic because you had to readjust the base. This one auto-adjusts itself. And it was fiddly. The old one was fiddly with filaments. Some filaments you could tune to work. Other filaments would just didn't work no matter what you did with them. So I got to kind of get to learn this 3D printer. It's the good things, the bad things. And since I unfortunately always seem to find myself on the bleeding edge, a lot of the software is alpha software. It's not even beta. So there's going to be a learning curve, and for both me and the guys programming the darn thing.
I've run into a couple of smaller projects that I was thinking of printing, and I had to scale them down because the Mini doesn't have that big of a base. So even the regular Prusa printer is quite a bit bigger. But you're going to be able to print like quite a few things at either at larger scale or just. Should be interesting. I'm kind of curious to see where you're going to get with that thing.
Yeah, hopefully if it doesn't drive me completely insane, it'll be loads of fun. My previous one was able to, I think it was something like 4.5 inches by 4.5 inches by 4.5 inches, which surprisingly was kind of small for models that I put in there. It was a regular thing that I had to scale them down so that they didn't poke out of the software. This is not going to be the case with this thing. If anything, I could probably scale them up. I could have full-size superhero masks if I was so inclined. Or I made a bunch of statues. I had good old Tesla, Nikola, and a bunch of them. But they were kind of small. I used a nice white, off-white plastic that really looked almost like marble. So it looked nice, but it was very small. So I'm thinking maybe I'll try some of those. The big problem is, what the heck do you do with all these damn things? Because they take up space. If you build them and you put in effort, and you don't want to just shove them in a shopping bag and shove them in the back of your closet. So it's not only the size of the 3D printer, which is humongous. Unfortunately, I was going to kind of put it on a coffee table and it would have rocked back and forth. So unfortunately, it's sitting on my dining room table. It should be fun.
Kind of like useful trying to solve a thing here or there, kind of made a few parts. Trying to use it, but I did print 16 mini ghosts for my daughter so she can give them out to school friends. That's pretty much plastic waste, but she liked it. She has like these mini ghosties that she gave out to friends. So it's kind of fun. It's a toy.
I'm curious, did anyone hear my last transmission where I mentioned Klein bottles?
Nope, you were silent there for a while.
Okay, well, the beauty of Echolink is sometimes it catches and sometimes it doesn't. I was just mentioning that I used to take these 3D puzzles to club meetings, and one guy was able to solve them, and he asked me if he could take it home to his daughter to see if she could solve it, so that was nice. And I went to Limark Hamventions for a year or two, and put a bunch of my stuff on a bench and showed them off. And, you know, there was all kinds of different geometric shapes and such. And at one point, I showed off a Klein bottle, which one guy passing by looked at it, did a double take, and said, gee, that's a Klein bottle. And I said, yes, it is. Yeah, do that. I find it fascinating. They actually sell glass-blown Klein bottles, but this, of course, was a plastic-produced Klein bottle. But they're one. You know, it's kind of like how a Mobius strip is, only in three dimensions or four dimensions instead of just the strip. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS, and this continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. I know we have one other person on Echolink, at least, so, you know, if he'd like to ask a question or have a comment, that's fine. If not, that's fine, too. But before we call it a night, I just thought I'd give people the opportunity. If anyone has any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk. It's for fun. It's a mathematical construct. It's a one surface bottle. It has no volume in it ultimately. So it's a geometry. It's a topology that's interesting and fascinating to some people. It does not have any intrinsic value in and of itself. There's nothing that you're going to build that gets run on the principles of a Klein bottle. But there are a lot of mathematical concepts that are much more difficult to visualize than something like a Klein bottle. You look at it and you sort of know inherently what's going on there. Yeah, they scale down rather well, so any size will do. And, you know, try and make it as out of as much translucent material as you can so that you kind of get an idea of what's going on inside the bottle. Okay, I think we're kind of getting to the end of tonight's episode, but, you know, like always, the endless optimist that I am, if anyone has any closing comments, questions, answers, statements, what have you, feel free to give it to us now. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be December 6th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be mailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts around 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser, stream.kc2rc.com. Members, as well as non-members, listeners are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, please address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and close it all down. We'll be back December 13th to do it all over again, and you're welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, William AC2ZV. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. Everyone have a great Thanksgiving. Eat a lot, but don't eat too much. Be well, stay safe, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is Roy AC2GS going clear and getting the heck out of here.
Look forward to chatting with you again on the 13th, and good night to you, Max, too. Good night, everyone.